Hi, this is Patrick Coffin, and welcome to the third and final interview in our series, How to Talk to Atheists. Father Robert Spitzer is a Catholic priest in the Jesuit order and is currently the president of the Majus Center for Reason and Faith in Irvine, California. He has appeared on Larry King Live, debating Stephen Hawking and Deepak Chopra on God and Modern Physics. And from 1998 to 2009, Father Spitzer was the president of Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington. He has published 5 books, including New Proofs for the Existence of God, Contributions of Contemporary Physics and Philosophy, which won the Catholic Press Association's award for Best Book in Faith and Science. Father Spitzer now joins us from the Majus Center for Reason and Faith in Irvine, California. Father Spitzer, nice to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you, Patrick. Thanks for having me on the program.
Well, we try to go for the best, and we think we found the best here with this series. So we're delighted that you took time to spend with us today to talk about this topic.
Well, thank you. I'm honored.
The topic of faith from the point of view of science and speaking with atheists from that point of view is really your bread and butter. So I'm glad that that you're the one we're going to focus on for this hour of how to talk to atheists from the scientific point of view, specifically the insights that you bring out in your book, New Proofs for the Existence of God, Contributions of Contemporary Physics and Philosophy. And my first question is this. I'll back into it this way. The topic is kind of... it's paradoxical because on the one hand, it's abstract. It deals with theorems and hypotheses and factual analysis and so on. But it's also very personal, especially for people with college-age kids who are up against atheist professors. Talk a little bit about how it's simultaneously abstract and very concrete.
Yeah, I think we partially have to make it concrete for people, and I think that can be done. And that's part of what we try to do at the Majus Center for Reason and Faith. So we have a variety of other tools besides the book, which can be used. So we have, for example, a documentary called Cosmic Origins, mm-hmm. where 8 physicists are discussing this material, but in a way that's very, palatable and understandable to a general audience. We have a high school curriculum called The Reason Series, What Science Says About God. That's for high school students. But a lot of adults, quite frankly, have come up and said, I really like your high school series. So they actually watch the dramatization part and actually do the workbook for the high school kids, and they like it. We also, though, have a college-aged one, an adult ed one called In the Beginning as well. Mm-hmm. And that's me giving a kind of a lecture series, but done in a way to a large audience where they can essentially understand the material, and I sort of break it down into bite-sized pieces. So the book is not for everyone, mm-hmm. Although it is for what I would call even a senior in high school who's scientifically inclined. It'll be a stretch for them, especially the science part in the first couple of chapters there might be a stretch, but honestly, they might be able to benefit from it. Mm-hmm. But I would say if somebody is not in that category of being a little bit more scientifically or logically or philosophically inclined, maybe to use one of the other resources, like the In the Beginning lecture series, which actually does go through the first 2 chapters of the book, mm-hmm. step by step, or the Reason series, which goes through a lot of questions, not only the evidence for God from physics, but actually takes on the whole area of near-death experiences and the recent scientific arguments for human self-consciousness surviving bodily death, or what's called clinical death. We also look at aliens and evolution and all the typical questions that smart high school students will ask. It's not a matter of will they. They will.
Right.
And so we do take all of them on, and we have various levels. And those maybe the other levels might be a little more appropriate to somebody who's just mm-hmm. not up for a theorem or two.
You've looked at aliens? They're real?
Well, of course, we have to consider the possibility of alien life forms, and then, of course, of intelligent alien life forms. And, yes, of course, that's going to presume the existence of a uniquely created soul. But there's very good reasons for saying that, which we talk about. And, of course, if God wanted to create an intelligent alien, he could. Mm-hmm. But there wouldn't be an intelligent alien like us that could, you know, as it were, think creatively beyond what's called Gödel's theorem. Mm-hmm. You really couldn't have that if God didn't create their unique soul.
We're going to talk about anthropic coincidences later, so I'm glad you kind of foreshadowed it here. What is a workable definition of science, Father Spitzer? Because science as a term is almost like a magic code word that is presumed to win all arguments automatically. What is science?
Science is a whole series of disciplines that works off what's called empirical hypothetico-deductive reasoning. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? Empirical means, first, it's based on observation. Now, observations can be many things, but of course it has to have some ground, some data in the physical world that can be observed or can be measured, or for which we can develop an experiment where we could eliminate other possibilities. So science then has three kinds of avenues to getting its data. It could make a direct empirical observation. It could make a measurement in the observable world. Or it could use a deduction, what's called hypothetical deduction, where I create a hypothesis. Then I create an experimental test for the hypothesis, which eliminates other possibilities. And, of course, if the empirical test proves the hypothesis, great. But all empirical tests mean falsifiability. So, in other mm-hmm. words, you know, if the empirical test does not prove it, then the hypothesis has to be, as it were, chucked out the window. And so we start all over again with a new hypothesis. But that's essentially how it works. And, you know, so it has its limits. Because, you know, it's an inductive discipline, and of course, it's also based on observation. And that's why you can't disprove God, for example, from science. And you can't even say that science knows everything about everything. Science only knows about observable things in the observable world. And frankly, what you can show with science is some limits to the observable world that could point to God. But for all intents and purposes, you know, science, like Stephen Hawking's claim, for example, that science has shown everything about the physical universe, we know now that we don't need God.
Yes.
That is a completely preposterous statement. And here's why, in a nutshell. And by the way, most scientists know this. I mean, we call science an inductive discipline. And the reason is it goes from particulars to theories or generalities. So I get all this particular data, datum 1, datum 2, datum 3, and I begin to form theories around all that data.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I think my theory's correct, but a new datum could be discovered that I didn't know about before because I haven't observed everything there is to observe, measured everything that there is to measure, or experimented upon everything that there is to experiment upon.
Right.
So something could be discovered which could force me to modify my theory. And this, you know, so we always say science must be open to ongoing discoveries. Now, for Stephen to claim that science now has explained everything means that Stephen has actually done the most remarkable feat in the world. He's observed everything there is to observe, and he has measured everything there is to measure, and experimented upon everything there is to experiment upon. So now he has the complete set of empirical data to know that his theory cannot be challenged successfully again. Of course, that's crazy. No scientist believes this. No scientist believes that Stephen Hawking has done this. But it's just put out as almost really ridiculous pap for, unfortunately, general audiences to consume. And, of course, it makes no sense whatsoever.
How is that bear on the distinction between induction versus deduction? Because the inductive thinking versus deductive is often a kind of fuzzy in people's minds.
Sure. A deduction, it would mean that you start off with a general principle. Could be like the principle of non-contradiction, right? That something can't be both X and not X mm-hmm. in the same respect at the same place and time. You can't have, for example, a square circle of the same area in the same respect at the same place and time. Mm-hmm. Because the boundaries of square exclude the boundaries of circle, right? You can't have a proton electron in the same respect at the same place and time, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
Okay, so essentially we know that contradictory states of affairs don't exist. And from these so-called first principles, or from first principles mixed with factual data, you can actually deduce through logic, what we call syllogisms, formal syllogisms, you can actually deduce conclusions that you can say we have metaphysical certitude about. For example, in chapter 3 of my book, I show that here's a proof for God's existence. If you deny that God exists, well, you're going to either have to contradict yourself, or you're going to have to deny your existence along with every other contingent being's existence. Mm-hmm. Now, I can force you to deny your existence or to argue an intrinsic contradiction. Now, if that's disagreeable to you, well, you're going to have to believe in God. But I've had students who come and say, well, I guess I don't exist. And
right,
I always
right.
say, well, then you don't have anything relevant to say to the class, because if you're nothing, we don't have to listen to nothing. So, mm-hmm. you know, and so forth. But, of course, you're going to have people who will deny even first principles. That's not done too often. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, if people agree with the first principles, then deduction can actually prove things with great certitude. Mm-hmm. Induction, conversely, because you're moving, instead of moving from first principles through logic to secondary principles, you're actually moving an induction from particular pieces of data. And particular means it's limited to a particular space-time point and to the physical universe. So it doesn't have what we call universal applicability, like the principle of non-contradiction, or A squared plus B squared equals C squared in, right. in a Euclidean universe, etc. So all these things that we call inductive, then, they have to be open to change, whereas things that we call deductive, right, they can actually be universally applicable. Well, and that's the distinction. And science, because it's based on observation, will always have to be inductive, and as inductive, it will always have to be open to further discovery. And as open to further discovery, you know, you can't say that science, first of all, has explained everything about everything. That's crazy, because, of course, science can only explain observational things and scientific things and observable, measurable things in principle.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And secondly, we don't even know whether we've got the complete set of data to have the theory about everything. All we know is we have the data we have right now, and that could be modified. And, of course, right now, we don't even know that string theory is true, which, for example, Stephen Hawking bases his whole book on M theory, because we don't have one scintilla of evidence for it.
Even
in
though,
fact, string theory has been lacking confirmation for so long, we now have competitor theories in what's called quantum cosmology and quantum gravity, right? We have competitor theories like loop quantum gravity, right, that are equal competitors to string theory, although string theory is more elegant. It explains many things. These competitors are being formed simply because we don't have empirical evidence to show observationally that string theory is true.
And yet it's being sold as the unified theory of everything.
Oh, yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. it's just, and of course, and then we now don't need God anymore because we now have string theory. Well, wait a minute. We're lacking two things. First of all, string theory may be an explanation for various kinds of particles, but you'll never know whether it explains everything about everything right. in the universe. Number two, it certainly is not going to explain whether or not God exists. And frankly, it doesn't and cannot explain what happened at the beginning. And that is the point when I was debating with Stephen and Leonard Mlodinow on the Larry King show a while back.
Mm-hmm.
This was one of the big, huge points in the debate. You know, can something come from nothing? And even Larry King at the end of it said to, you know, Leonard Mlodinow, well, yeah, Leonard, you know, how can you make something come from nothing? And, yeah, of course, he didn't give an explanation of that. And the reason is he couldn't.
Right.
Because it makes no sense.
Yeah, as Maria sang in The Sound of Music, nothing comes from nothing.
From
right?
Nothing, exactly.
Father, I thought I'd turn the tables on the professor a little bit and ask,
sure,
you kind of a true or false pop quiz. I'll make a statement, you say true or false, and I'll give you a chance to clarify or give a caveat, okay?
All right.
We'll go through half a dozen or so. True or false, the rise of the scientific method itself took place because of Christian faith.
True. Basically, scientific method was born, first of all, out of a Christian university environment that really believed in the complete intelligibility of the world as created by God. Mm-hmm. When you start to look at who is responsible for the various applications of scientific method, you'll see that there are priests everywhere present in it. For example, Copernicus, who many of your audience members know, he was the first person to propose a heliocentric theory of the universe, where the sun is at the center of the solar system,
yes,
and all the planets rotate around it. He was a Catholic cleric. And then, of course, you probably know that the father of the Big Bang Theory is Father Georges Lemaître, and he was the one who not only discovered the Big Bang Theory, but was responsible for the first Lemaître constant. And, of course, that in turn was the possibility to have Hubble improve on it with the Hubble constant, but it really was Lemaître's theory, it was Lemaître's constant, and, of course, he was a Belgian priest.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might know, too, that genetics came out of an Augustinian monk, Gregor Mendel.
See, and now you're stealing from future questions, Father.
Oh, okay.
But it's a nice segue to the second one. True or false, there is a dichotomy between science and Christian faith.
Absolutely false. There is no dichotomy between science and Christian faith. As a matter of fact, if you look at the documentary, The Cosmic Origins, or you look at the book, New Proofs for the Existence of God, or any of the curricula that I just mentioned, we go through all the evidence for how physics actually today points to a creator, not away from it. And we do that through three very scientific methods. The first is called space-time geometry proofs. The best of those proofs come from three physicists, Arvin Borda at the Kavli Institute at the University of California, Santa Barbara, Alexander Vilenkin, who's the director of the Institute of Cosmology at Tufts University in Boston, and Alan Guth, who is at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in physics and cosmology.
Mm-hmm.
And, by the way, Guth is also the father of inflationary theory, which is a very important part of contemporary Big Bang cosmology. But the long and the short of it is there's a space-time geometry proof put out by them, which has only one condition, and it's very, very probobitive. That means there's a tremendous, it gets to a level of certitude in science, which is very good. Mm-hmm. And the best part about it is there's observational evidence to sustain it in every form that it has. So that's much better, as it were, than very speculative, reliances upon string theory and,
sure,
and so forth, and higher dimensional space and string theory. And we also look at the evidence for God from entropy. Entropy is the second law of thermodynamics and physics. Basically, it really is both a statistical and a thermodynamic theory or law about systems that move irreversibly from states of order to states of disorder. And, of course, the reason that it's an irreversible process is because the states of disorder are so much more probable than the states of order. And these states of order almost require a kind of fine-tuning in order to get to a super-ordered state. And that, of course, it presents a double problem. The first is, if time were infinite, then, of course, everything should be in a complete state of disorder right now, which would be tantamount to, like, microwave background radiation, right? And the whole universe should be that. But in point of fact, the universe is not. microwave background radiation. Mm-hmm. It has stars and planets, and even physicists who think about it, which are highly, highly ordered systems. And all of these things, of course, show that the universe could not have been around for an infinite amount of time, moving irreversibly from states of order to disorder. In fact, the entropy in our universe is quite low, and it seems highly improbable that the universe has even bounced once. And there's a lot of reasons for thinking that there can't be a bouncing universe. And, of course, a bouncing universe would be expanding, then contracting, then re-expanding and recontracting, etc.
Right. So we know that only babies bounce, truly speaking.
Right.
Okay. True or false? Many of the greatest scientists have been Catholic priests and prelates.
True. I mean, as I said, Copernicus, certainly the heliocentric theory, certainly Gregor Mendel, who was responsible for genetics, at least the whole foundational principles of genetics, was an Augustinian monk. Father Georges Lemaître, who discovered the Big Bang theory, and of course, Big Bang cosmology itself, was a Belgian priest who got his doctorate at MIT there and was a colleague of Einstein's. Mm-hmm. And by the way, you know, science is even like geology, etc. Even in the Galilean controversy, I mean, the Jesuits at the Roman College provided Galileo with the mathematics behind the heliocentric theory. The church was not against heliocentrism. The church was against claiming heliocentrism had been proven by stellar parallax. And, of course, the observational capacities at the time were so poor that you couldn't use stellar parallax to prove that the Earth was moving relative to the sun or the sun was moving relative to the Earth. You just couldn't prove it at the time. Mm-hmm. And so the Jesuits and the Pope of the time just said, don't claim this to be fact. So, of course, Galileo turns around in the two New World systems, claims it's not only a fact, but basically calls the Pope a fool. He puts the Pope's words into a character named Simplicio, which means, of course, simple-minded or idiot. Mm-hmm. All the Jesuits, of course, abandoned ship at that point, but it had nothing to do with science or openness to science or openness to the heliocentric solar system, etc. Sure. I mean, it's just completely has been misgauged from day one. But no, the Jesuits very much were involved in science and continue to be. In fact, one of the best observatories for a long time was the predecessor to the Gregorian University in Rome. It was at St. Ignatius there.
We could spend all day exploding myths like that, couldn't we?
Yes.
True or false? The Big Bang was God's way of saying, let there be light.
Well, I would say true. I would say the Big Bang implies a creation. If there were some period prior to the Big Bang, we can show that that prior period also would need a beginning. But the reason we can say that that says let there be light is because if there were a period prior to the Big Bang, it would have to be something like a multiverse or some kind of higher dimensional string theoretical universe. All these things would have a beginning, but it would not be a universe like our universe, which would have the planets that we have and would eventually give rise to a life form. That really begins with the Big Bang. And even in a multiverse, the odds of having any universe like our own that could give rise to a life form are just so infinitesimally small, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, 10 raised to the 10 raised to the 123 to 1 against it, right? I mean, this is a very, very difficult property to prove. But the point, of course, is at the end of the day, when you look at the whole stretch, the whole immense unraveling, as it were, of the universe over 13.7 billion years, you can actually see that everything was kind of fine-tuned for life forms to exist. And we can talk about that later when we talk about anthropic coincidences.
Yep.
But yes, true. That is God's way of saying not only let there be light, but let there be life, just like the prologue of St. John's Gospel.
Final question. Nothing is something.
False.
Oh, that was a half a joke.
Yeah.
But also half serious. In his televised debate this past Easter, the atheist Richard Dawkins was debating Cardinal Pell of Australia on live television. And Cardinal Pell began to grin as Dr. Dawkins was waxing eloquent on the concept of nothing. And he kind of blurted out, Dr. Dawkins brought out, what's so funny? He was kind of angry at the audience. And His Eminence said something to the effect of, you're just spending a lot of time discussing nothing. So what is nothing? That which precedes the Big Bang as nothing, but what is it?
Nothing is nothing, and that's what we have to insist upon. If you want to say that a low energy state of a quantum field, if you want to talk about that, don't call it nothing. Call it the low energy state of a quantum field. If you want to talk about the law of gravitation, don't call the law of gravitation nothing. The law of gravitation is something. It's a law of gravitation. Now, you might say, well, if there's no physical universe for the law of gravitation to be in, then where is it or what is it? Well, of course, it would have to be like a Platonic idea, or it would have to be held in existence by a mentative or thinking state. And if that's the case, then who's doing the thinking of the law of gravitation when there's no universe? Don't call it nothing. It's something. If you want to say that there was a void before the universe, a void is not nothing. A void is three-dimensional or four-dimensional, whatever, how many dimensions you want for your void. But the key thing is you can have more or less of a void, more or less of a vacuum, more or less of empty space, more or less of empty space-time, which is dimensional and orientable. But you can't have more or less of nothing, because nothing is nothing. Now, here is the important point. If nothing is truly nothing, and by the way, Stephen Hawking and Richard Dawkins know this very well, if nothing is truly nothing, then the only thing that nothing can do is nothing. And if the universe were truly nothing prior to the beginning, which physicists would agree, prior to an absolute beginning, the universe and its physical time was nothing, and that means nothing in the sense of nothing, then the universe could not have moved itself from nothing to something, because it was nothing and could only do nothing. Mm-hmm. Therefore, something else would have had to have moved it from nothing to something when it was nothing. And that something else would have to not only create the universe as a whole, but it would have to be transcendent. That is to say, it would have to be beyond the universe. It would not be controlled by the universe. This other entity or agency we call God or the Creator would actually be controlling it.
And it would have to be all-powerful to get it from zero to one.
Yep. Okay. That is precisely the point. And that's why a beginning in physics is a very, very big deal.
And in writing an essay for professor, too. starting's half the battle.
All right.
This is going to
have... True or false, eh?
Yeah, did you like that?
Yeah, I did.
Hey,
that
you know,
great.
I have good news. You passed.
Oh, good.
Father Spitzer, how did Father Lemaître and Alexander Friedman arrive at what we now call the Big Bang Theory? I mean, here we are, you know, 80 years later, and we sort of take it for granted, but the current model is rather a recent development, is it not?
Yeah, actually it is. I mean, up until 1923 to 1927, right in that area where, of course, Lemaître was working on the theory, most people thought, as Newton, Sir Isaac Newton did, that the universe was eternal. And then all of a sudden, starting in 23 to 27, when Lemaître is working on publicizing this theory, there was a problem, essentially, with a condition or an assumption about Einstein's general theory of relativity. And the problem was really the velocity of what's called extragalactic nebulae. And what that meant was there were light sources outside of our galaxy, which we today know were other galaxies. Mm-hmm. But at the time, it just looked like light sources. But the problem was the recessional velocity of these bodies outside of our galaxy was going, they were going way too fast to be explained by the general theory. And so Father Lemaître comes up with this radical theory where he says, well, look, You know, in the general theory of relativity, space can actually stretch. And so, like the elastic on a balloon. And so, basically, he shows that the stretching of space, like the elastic, you know, on a balloon that's being blown up, if you were to assume that, then all these galaxies would actually be pulling away from us, and the galaxies which are further away, because there's more space to stretch between me and them, because of that, they should be pulling away faster than the ones that are closer in, etc. And so, of course, what he notices then is he says, look, I can mathematically prove that if the universe started off like a completely deflated balloon, and then you put a bunch of dots on the completely deflated balloon, then you start blowing up the balloon and you notice that all the dots are moving away from all the other dots, right? I can actually prove to you why the recessional velocities of extragalactic nebulae would be receding faster as the distance grows away from me, the observer. And he not only shows that, but he actually mathematically comes to a constant which shows precisely the rate at which this would occur. And this Lemaître constant was revised by Edwin Hubble, but for all intents and purposes, it becomes the Big Bang Theory. And once that happens, you know, Einstein, at first, he didn't like it. He said, wait a minute here. You know, I find this kind of a little bit repulsive, you know, physically speaking. He says, your mathematics is great, Father Lemaître, but your, you know, the physics of it is almost preposterous. But later, Einstein actually agreed that it was the most beautiful theory of creation that he had ever encountered. And, of course, Edwin Hubble takes him up to an observatory, which is very close to us here, Mount Wilson Observatory, and shows precisely the redshifting of the various extragalactic nebulae, which we now know are galaxies, to Einstein, and he becomes a believer in that theory. But it's true, prior to really 1923, people thought the universe was eternal in the scientific community, and after that, there has been, obviously, the great debate of whether there truly was a beginning to the physical universe. You know, the Jews and the Christians were the only ones who really had any sense of, and of course the Muslims as well, who had a sense of having a beginning of the physical universe, but they did that theologically.
Yes.
With Lemaître, it now becomes scientific.
Talk a little bit about how the Big Bang Theory was confirmed through radio wave detection and speculation about the immense temperature that had to have been present at the beginning.
Right. I mean, essentially, just think of it this way. First of all, the red shifting of these galaxies actually tells you what the recessional velocity is. So
who think that redshift has to do with learning how to drive a stick.
Oh, yeah.
What is redshifting and what is that?
Yeah, well, when you do spectroscopy, you will notice that if something is moving away from you, it shifts the spectrum toward the red end of the spectrum. And the reason is because infrared light is very low frequency light. So that's where you have the night vision goggles, right? And you can see things with the night vision goggles because it's sensitive to the infrared end of the spectrum, which, of course, is present at night. Alternatively, if something were moving towards you, right, it would shift the frequency toward the blue end of the spectrum, which is the ultraviolet end of the spectrum. And remember, see, if it's moving toward you, it increases the frequency of the light. It makes the light more violent, right? Ultraviolet light's what gives you a sunburn. So something moving away from you, why, that would weaken the frequency. Something moving towards you would strengthen the frequency. So when you have a weakening frequency, it shows up as a red shift. And when you have a strengthening one, it shows up as a blue shift. So I can actually tell, by using spectroscopy, I can actually tell if an object is moving away from me or towards me. And more than that, I can actually tell how fast it's moving away from me. And, of course, it's that precise data that showed, right, that the extragalactic nebulae that were further away should be moving faster away. And, of course, Hubble was able to confirm it. Then another group of people, well, it didn't just start with Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson, but they were the ones who actually discovered the data for it. But just think for a moment in your mind, hey, let's back the universe up to the Big Bang itself and what that would have been like. Well, there would have had to have been, right, a tremendous force to make the universe, as it were, you know, kind of explode and move into its expansion. Now, today we know that part of that is caused by inflation and by dark energy. But also there is a kind of explosion that takes place in the very first moments of the Big Bang. And this explosion or this release of energy that takes place in the very first moment of the Big Bang, right, it spreads out, right, as the universe, you know, gets bigger and bigger. So let's just go back to our balloon analogy for just a moment. Mm-hmm. And if you take the elastic on the balloon and let's say you put a little bit of peanut butter or something on it, right, and you just keep blowing up the balloon and the peanut butter spreads evenly as the balloon is blowing up, you'll notice that the peanut butter gets thinner and thinner and thinner as the balloon gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, like this residual radiation, that's like a shock wave, right? The residual shock wave from the Big Bang, as this gets spread thinner and thinner, it really gets to a very, very, very low frequency, right, toward the infrared end of the spectrum there. And it gets so low that it actually goes way beneath the infrared and to the microwave end of the frequency. In fact, what Dr. Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson discovered was that it got to 2.7 degrees Kelvin in terms of thermal radiation, which means just 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. Now, you'd say, well, how could you possibly measure it? Well, you can't measure it by sticking a thermometer out into the universe. But what it does have is what's called a microwave effect. So that on the microwave frequency, like a radio signal could perceive it. And in point of fact, they developed a radio antenna at Bell Labs that was trying to eliminate all possible noise. And what they found out was there was a noise no matter what they did. And that noise, of course, turned out to be the residual radiation from the Big Bang. And it happened to be precisely the temperature that would have been predicted by looking at the current size of the universe.
I believe Dr. Penzias talks about this on the documentary.
He does talk about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why he got the Nobel Prize for it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the universe is 13.7 billion years old, probably plus or minus 200 million years, which is...
But who's counting?
Yeah, but who's counting exactly at 13.7 exactly?
Father Spitzer, in my recent interview with Dr. William Lane Craig on the philosophical aspect of talking to atheists, we discussed David Hilbert and finite mathematics. Now, my listeners know I did not get the math gene, but I want to take another pass at it from a different angle, and that is, how much of a lift did theism, that a transcendent creator made the universe and you and me, receive from the Big Bang theory? Because the idea, or I should say the presupposition of an eternal universe, vanishes in the face of the Big Bang theory. How is that good for theism?
Well, essentially, when you're talking about a Hilbertian argument like Dr. Craig was talking about, that is a philosophical or logical argument, and mm-hmm. it's also a mathematical argument. Well, if you're a logician or a mathematician, that argument is probably going to have a great deal of probative force for you. That you're going to think that that's a pretty good argument. Mm-hmm. But if you're not too familiar with the math part of things, you may be more what's called empirically inclined.
Yes.
And empirically inclined people really like observational data, which is what we call falsifiable. That means by an experiment you could show that it is false just as well as showing that it is true. So by observational evidence you could show that it's false. Mm-hmm. And so the key thing, of course, is with the Big Bang, now you have a set of data which is falsifiable. And let's suppose you know somebody tells you, well, no, the Big Bang was not the beginning. but in point of fact, there could have been a period prior to the Big Bang. Okay, let's suppose that's true. But we can also now have observationally based theories that would show, well, what would be the physical ground for this? And then you can turn around and you can apply physical laws, for example, the Board of Lincoln and Guth proof. You can actually show that even if you had a period prior to the Big Bang, or even if you had a multiverse, in which our universe is just one bubble universe, or even if string theory were true, and you had a higher dimensional space, and our universe just popped out of a collision of two three-dimensional brains and four-dimensional bulk space-time or something like that, of course, which is right now complete fantasy. But let's suppose you really believe that that was true. You can show that every single one of those models has a beginning by the Board of Lincoln and Guth proof, which came out in 2003. And interestingly enough, you can actually get back to an absolute beginning, even of multiverses, of string theoretical, higher-dimensional space universes, etc. For all intents and purposes, we are dealing with falsifiable, observational-based data and laws which can actually show a beginning. And that's very satisfying to people who are empirically and scientifically inclined. They're looking for observational data and they're looking for falsifiable data, and now they can get it. And Alexander Lincoln has a wonderful little YouTube video where he goes through all the steps in that proof in a very scientific, professional way. And you can, I can send you that link if you want to see it.
That would be great. You mentioned Alexander Lincoln earlier, probably the cosmologist at the director of the Institute of Cosmology at Tufts University. Wouldn't you love to have been a fly on the wall when he crashed Stephen Hawking's 70th birthday party and presented a paper on the beginning actually having a beginning?
Oh, yeah. In fact, Lisa Grossman, who I think covered it for the New Scientist and the New York Times, called Lincoln's paper, Why Physicists Can't Avoid a Beginning, the worst birthday present ever.
Nice.
Alexander Lincoln actually has come out with a very bold statement, which he makes on the basis of this proof I was talking about, the Board of Lincoln and Guth proof from 2003. Basically, I'm paraphrasing this, but I'm getting it pretty close to his exact quote. It is said that a good argument will convince a reasonable man, and that a proof will convince even an unreasonable one. Well, now that the proof is in place, and here he's talking about the Board of Lincoln and Guth proof.
Yes.
Well, now that the proof is in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind even the possibility of a past eternal universe. Mm-hmm. There's no escape. They must confront the reality of a beginning. And that's a pretty bold statement. At one point, he actually said, to view an inflationary universe without a beginning is impossible.
And who is this again?
This is Dr. Alexander Valenkin.
This is the Valenkin quote, okay.
The director of the Institute of Cosmology at Tufts University in Boston.
I want to segue now, Father Spitzer, to anthropic coincidences and the anthropic principle. I just read very recently that if in the first nanoseconds following that primal event we're calling the Big Bang, if the temperature had been off by a degree of 30 decimal places, the souffle of the universe that in which we're living now would have been gruel, and you and I would not be talking right now. That seems to me to be at least a powerful thought experiment, if not an outright proof.
Yeah, we don't want to call it a proof, but what we do want to say is it's very probative evidence for what we call fine-tuning, and that's what implies intelligence behind the creation. Essentially, what you have there is one of these so-called cosmic coincidences, and we have 20 universal constants, and a universal constant is, it's just a number, like the speed of light constant, 300,000 kilometers per second or 186,200 miles per second, or Planck's constant, which many of your readers might know about, which basically converts frequencies into the point at which energy will be expended. Or then you have all four of the forces of the universe. There are four forces in the universe, and all of them have constants associated with them. So, for example, the gravitational constant G, many people might have studied that in their physics class. That's the gravitational constant. And the strong nuclear force has the strong nuclear force coupling constant associated with this. The weak force, which is responsible for radiation and particle decay, it has a weak force constant. And the electromagnetic force, it has three constants associated with it, the mass of the proton, the mass of the electron, and the electromagnetic charge. Now, let's say there's 20 major constants in our universe. These numbers are not only controlling all the equations of physics, they're actually controlling all the laws of nature. And we can make very exact predictions about what would happen to the universe if those numbers had been off ever so slightly from their current values. You could actually tell what the universe would be like if that were to occur. So, for example, I'll just give you a couple of examples. If your gravitational constant and weak force constant were off by only one part in 10 to the 50th, higher or lower,
mm-hmm.
one part in 10 to the 50, which is a small fraction, right? That's a decimal point with 49 zeros and a one. Very small fraction, higher or lower, then either the universe would have been continuously exploding in its expansion, which, by the way, is very bad for life forms, or the universe would have collapsed into a black hole, where, right, the entire mass density of the universe would be crushed into 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, which is, again, equally bad for life forms. Now, can you imagine just those two constants off by one part in 10 to the 50th, higher or lower, and we've got a universe incapable of sustaining any life forms?
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the Big Bang, those two constants could have been just about anything higher or lower. I mean, we hit the mark at the Big Bang just by pure accident. Or here's another one. Let's just say that the electromagnetic charge, or the mass of the proton compared to the mass of the electron, or the gravitational constant, were off by an equally small fraction, higher or lower. All the stars in our universe would have been either blue giants or red dwarfs. If they were all blue giants, everything would be incinerated. Very bad for life forms. If they were all red dwarfs, everything would freeze to death because there wouldn't be enough heat energy to do anything. So you're either incinerated to death or you're frozen out of life. Either way, you know, the point is, lucky those four constants were exactly what they were. Or if the strong nuclear force coupling constant were 2% higher, you'd have no hydrogen in the universe whatsoever. If it were 2% lower, you'd have no element heavier than hydrogen. Both of these scenarios would be equally bad for life forms, right? If you don't have any hydrogen, you have no nuclear fuel or water that's required for life, or alternatively, no element heavier than hydrogen, you have no bondable element like carbon that can give rise to complex properties, right, like life forms.
Well, that's the title of your next book. It's also the last line of the movie Napoleon Dynamite. Lucky! There it is. You can use that for free, Father.
Okay, I'll do it. But, I mean, you can just admit, oh, are you kidding me? I don't think luck has anything to do with it.
Sure.
And that's why most physicists who don't want to believe in God, the intelligence behind all of that fine-tuning, they always have to make recourse to a multiverse. But here's the problem with the multiverse. The multiverse also requires fine-tuning. Because even though this is a completely hypothetical, completely speculative theory, right? Even though that's the truth, let's suppose a multiverse existed. Then you can, my book makes this very clear, then you can see that you don't want those bubble universes which you're coughing out of your multiverse, you don't want them bumping into each other or adversely affecting each other in the space of the multiverse. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, if you start having bubble universes bump into each other, why, the whole of space-time will wiggle like a jello. And if that were to happen, it would really make any kind of organized system or even the evolutionary processes required for an organized system, mm-hmm. impossible to develop. So all of a sudden, then, you got to have a slow, orderly roll of bubble universes and so forth, which all requires fine-tuning. And all we've done is put the fine-tuning problem back one step based on a speculation in order to get out of the problem of fine-tuning in our universe.
Right, so it kicks the same can just further down the avenue.
Further down that road, and at the same time, what you're doing is you now have to postulate a trillion, 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 trillion bubble universes just to explain ours.
Right.
You know, which is kind of a violation of what's called the law of parsimony or Occam's razor. But anyway, you get the point. It's just, it's ridiculous. Boy, the things people will do to get out of saying God.
I wanted to ask you about the people that you interviewed in Cosmic Origins, the documentary. I mean, these are the very best Nobel laureates, a Harvard astronomer, NASA scientist, Templeton Prize winners.
Right.
I got the sense that folks like this are no longer shy to come out of the closet as people who follow the evidence where it takes them. And I wanted to ask you if these brilliant men and women are part of a trend in which people of science are discovering the incredible harmony between the findings of science and the data of revelation.
Well, I think there are many, many people, you know, scientists who believe this. And I think there are a lot of younger ones who won't come out of the closet because they are scared about their academic careers, mm-hmm. or even their research careers at various labs. Now, when you get a little older, right, so you're around 50 years old, you're established, you've written your books, it's really hard to fire you, you know, if you have an important research position, or it's really hard to kind of disdain you when you get a Nobel Prize, or it's really hard to sort of kick you out of academe when you have tenure and a full professorship, then these people actually do come out and begin to declare that they really do have a belief in God. I mean, mm-hmm. and some of them come a little bit later on, you know, like Fred Hoyle, for example. Sir Fred Hoyle, who used to be the big atheist gadfly of the physics community.
Yeah, he was the Anthony Flew of physics, wasn't he?
He really was, and then he turned right around, and after I think his partner, William Fowler, pointed out to him, you know, the high, high, high improbability of carbon bonding through, you know, the resonance levels of beryllium, oxygen, helium, and carbon. He basically came back with a quote. Again, I'm just paraphrasing, but it's something like, "I do not think that there are any blind forces worth speaking about. It seems to me that there must have been some super intellect that monkeyed with the constants of physics and chemistry and biology as well to make the possibility of a life form within the scope of reality. I consider this to be beyond the shadow of a doubt." And so, essentially, he not only believed in a transcendent God, but of a highly intelligent God, very much like, for example, an Albert Einstein kind of a God, for sure. You know, highly intelligent, very, very powerful kind of a God, and who is highly intelligent. You know, that's what can happen when you study physics as deeply as Hoyle did. And you have the authenticity and the academic freedom to be able to declare it with some impunity in public.
So atheists need to be careful what books they select to read.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, as ever, Father Spitzer, I wish we had more time. Thanks so much for helping us more effectively talk to atheists. The website is magisreasonfaith.org. The book is New Proofs for the Existence of God, Contributions of Contemporary Physics and Philosophy. Our guest, Father Robert Spitzer. Thanks, Father, and thanks for your priesthood.
Oh, thank you, Patrick, and God bless you.
Thank you for listening to this three-part series, How to Talk to Atheists, produced by Catholic Answers. For more information on atheism or on any topic related to Catholic apologetics and evangelization, visit our website at catholic.com.